This is Eleanor Swent continuing the interview with Frank Joklik in Salt Lake City on January 20th, 1994. Okay.
So, I was making progress with the marketing, but I hadn't really hit the right button. I could tell that. And I recognized that the only way that I was really going to be successful with a potential off-taker of our share of the production would be to bring them in at the same time as equity participants. But that wasn't everybody's cup of tea as far as these potential candidates were concerned. Meanwhile, Agrico or Williams people, recognizing our increasing embarrassment with this marketing position, were adopting the attitude, well, why don't we buy you out? And we had at that time spent something like maybe $20 million on our efforts in relation to that project, going all the way back to 1955. And Texas Gulf came along, I remember, and offered us $35 million cash for our share of the project. And there was some sentiment in Kennecott to accept that. Now, I'm talking a little bit later in the game here. I think I'm talking maybe 1978 here, and I'd like to continue this through to the logical conclusion, even though it skips over a number of years. Mm-hmm. When I say there was some sentiment in Kennecott to accept that, I'm really talking about Tom Barrow, because Frank Millican had retired, and I'll have to leave that blank here. He'd retired in 1978, and Tom Barrow, who had been vice chairman of Exxon, was elected Kennecott's president and CEO on January 12th, 1978. No. Yeah, that's right, that's correct. And Tom, you know, got familiar with the history of the project, and he really thought that it was time perhaps to cut the umbilical cord. So he was quite intrigued in that offer, but I said no way, or over my dead body, because I had by then established contact with someone who I thought might not only take share of the output but also take an equity position, and that was Superfos of Denmark. When Agrico became aware of our potential ties with Superfund, with Superfos, they became quite agitated because they could see that here potentially was a nascent major competitor with our mining expertise and Superfos marketing capabilities. And I could see what was going on in their minds. I pursued my ties with Superfos until one day we had a call from the Williams people saying we need to talk.
Did you have regular meetings with them? And
with whom?
With Agricol. You must have been.
Oh, we were joint venture partners.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were meeting with them.
Yeah. Regularly.
How often?
Oh, I couldn't tell you.
Once a month?
Something like that, or more often, perhaps at times.
So they were aware of all these marketing trips you were making? And
no, it was our business.
Okay. So how did they find out about Superfos?
Oh, it's a small world in the phosphate, the phosphate business. So they came, and I'm jumping ahead here quite a bit, I think, to 1979, by which time we were already in Salt Lake. And they came to see us, Glenn Bakken and myself. Glenn Bakken was then the president of Kennecott here. And, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that meeting was in Stamford, Connecticut, after Kennecott's office moved out to Stamford. Anyway, they came to see us. I remember the meeting very clearly. And they said, well, we really think it's time to come to the parting of the ways here, and we want to buy you guys out. So we said, really? Really think you want to do that? It's going to cost you. And they said, yes, yes, we realize that, but we're ready to bite the bullet. So we sat there, dead silence for a while, and they said, well, we thought of a price of $150 million. Glenn and I both tried to keep our composure, and we looked at each other, and I said, I think we need to caucus. So we left the room, and outside we said, did they say $150 million? We said, yes, they said that. So we said, well, the worst thing we could do is to insult these people by taking $150 million. What we have to do is to, you know, make them feel good, is ask for $165 million. So we went back in the meeting and said, with long face, said, gentlemen, we find your offer extremely disappointing, but we recognize that we're having increasingly difficult of jointly doing this project. It's going to cost you $165 million.
Maybe speak a little louder.
So they looked somewhat disappointed, but nevertheless I could see that there was no way they were going to turn that down. And before the meeting was over, they said, okay, it's a deal at $165 million. So that with us having $20 million in the project. We made the deal, the sale was effective. Superfos people were understandably very disappointed, and I must say I have a guilty conscience about my relationship with them. That's the good news. The not-so-good news is that we've now advanced to 1979, and at that time, Kennecott was trying to disengage from the hassle with Curtis Wright,
yeah,
with Roland Berner over the ownership of Kennecott. And I'll come back to that, but part of the final settlement was that Kennecott was going to buy the Curtis Wright subsidiary, the Dorr Oliver Company, Stamford, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And the price that was agreed upon was about $160 million. That was far more than should have been paid for Dorr Oliver. Far more. And the good money got from the sale of North Carolina Phosphate went to a cause that was less than admirable.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the story of North Carolina Phosphate.
Hmm. Mm. The money came in handy, but...
yeah, but could have been applied more appropriately, perhaps. The other principal project that we got involved in during those years of exploration from 1974 to 1979 was the Questa molybdenum project.
Mm-hmm.
And this came about as a result of Molycorp, which was then an independent public company, Molycorp was operating the Questa mine.
This was in New Mexico, wasn't it?
In the foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, mm-hmm, in northern New Mexico.
Yeah.
At a rate to satisfy a milling capacity of 15,500 tons a day. Open pit operations. Moly prices were about $2.50 a pound, and the outlook for moly was good because the General Services Administration had just disposed of their last 35 million pounds of MOS-2 in their stockpile, and that which had kept a damper on the market. So it seemed as if the price was going to remain strong for some year, and that actually turned out to be the case. So they were looking for a partner to expand the operations and develop further deposits at Questa, which they'd gotten a whiff of. So we negotiated a 2-year option agreement with them to earn a 50% interest, and what we had to do was spend a minimum of $5 million during those 2 years. Well, we got into it.
Now, had this been done before you came back?
No.
No.
This
you,
is what,
you initiated.
When I say we, always mean right. Something that
okay.
I did.
Uh-huh. The royal
I like to use the...
Editorial we.
Yeah, whatever. man, or the people I negotiated with, were the two brothers, whose name I'll remember in a minute. And the local manager at Molycorp was Gene Dewey. But he had a pretty good team there. Technically, they were really competent. We got in there, and Dewey appointed a project manager, which was Gordon Lister, one of our very economically oriented geologists at the time. And we went in there and set about drilling. And to cut a long story short, we, in pretty short order, well, when I say short order, it took a couple of years, proved up 124 million tons, averaging 0.32% MOS2, which would have to be mined largely underground. I mean, 0.32 is a pretty good grade, but underground mining, you know, Amax, Henderson, they're more in the 0.4 range, MOS2. And there certainly looked like being plenty of potential for more beyond that tonnage. So we were contemplating a block caving operation at 30,000 tons a day, producing 28 million pounds a year of MOS2. And the price by 1977 had risen to $4 a pound, as opposed to the $2.43 a pound when we made the joint venture agreement with Molycorp. Now, a dampening thing at that time was Amex commissioned the Henderson mine in 1977, and it was rated to produce 50 million pounds a year. Well, 50 million pounds a year of new supply was going to be quite a market depressant. But that didn't scare us off. What did scare us off in the end was none other than the Federal Trade Commission, of whom Kennecott had had bad experiences, both in connection with the Okanite acquisition, when I worked on that Copper Mines of the World study, and later on the Peabody acquisition, which was challenged. I'm not sure whether it was the Federal Trade Commission or the Justice Department, but I always think of those two interchangeably. But what happened in this case was that the Federal Trade Commission simply phoned us and said, look, we know you're thinking of going to phase two of this project, namely the implementation of this new mine there at Cuesta. And we want to warn you that on account of your moly production from your porphyry copper deposits, we're going to challenge the project. And you may find that you waste a hell of a lot of money in the end, have to divest yourself as you've had to in other cases. And it was a brutal phone call. And I was pretty critical of the poor relations that Kennecott had with the executive branch and the legislative branch in Washington. They had representation there, but it was sort of treated as an adjunct. I learned later on the way to lobby in Washington is to go yourself and go often and get to know everybody, no matter how frequently the personnel they turn over, but you got to be right in there with them. And it was just shocking that the FTC with a phone call could scare Kennecott off this project.
So Kennecott was producing molybdenum as a byproduct of its copper.
Right, right.
And wanted to go into a straight molybdenum project.
Yes, yeah.
And this was considered restraint of free trade or whatever.
That's right, that Kennecott would be producing an excessive amount of the world's molybdenum.
Although
and that the expansion of Cuesta was not really a new discovery, that we had bought our way into this 50% joint venture and that we shouldn't have done that.
Although Amex was producing more still.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, you know, there weren't many other producers,
no,
especially not from pure moly plays. Now,
When was Borax, U.S. Borax, trying to produce its big one up in Alaska? Wasn't this about the same time?
At Ketchikan?
Mm-hmm.
I think that came a little later.
Quartz Hill,
yeah. Mm-hmm. That came a little later, I think.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
But, and there was also Thompson in, Idaho.
Okay.
And, oh, what is the one down in, Arizona?
I don't know.
Anyway, what happened was that moly prices declined after the late 70s. And why? Because with the revival of the, it was a function of the decline of the economy, which meant less oil welding. I mean, what drives moly production is the manufacture of drill pipe. And when there's less demand for domestic, when there's less rigs operating in the United States, the demand for moly goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And when it happens in the United States, it tends to happen worldwide. So this declined, and byproduct production of moly increased, particularly in Chile. The Chileans hadn't bothered about recovering moly much, but late 70s and the 80s, they got geared up to produce large amount of moly from their major porphyry copper mines, and that had a depressing effect on the market. And it put tremendous pressure on the pure moly producers. They went out of business. I mean, Kennecott's Alice Arm project up in British Columbia fizzled out. Thompson Creek went by the board. The other one I'm trying to think of went out. Quartz Hill never materialized. Mm-hmm. And Questa in the end ceased operations.
Hmm.
And Amex had to reduce production tremendously, shut down Climax totally, reduced production at Henderson, and moly from pure moly mines became so vulnerable to moly that costs 60 or 70 cents a pound to produce from porphyry coppers, which is all it is, separate cost, it couldn't compete no matter how low you drove your costs in pure moly mines. So we decided then in the end not to pursue phase two, and we got bought out by Molycorp for I think $13 million, which was about twice what we had in the project. So,
and you didn't attempt to fight the FTC phone call at all, you just...
That wasn't my call. That decision was made in you know,
but I gather you would
chairman's office.
You would have gone to bat for it.
Of fighting them?
Right.
No, not with the history that I'd had. You know, I'd watched the proceedings on Okunite and on Peabody. And what I figured is that you should never let it come to that.
You prevent it.
But you don't let it get that far.
Mm-hmm.
You make sure you have clearance, and until you have clearance, you don't proceed.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just go in and allow them to attack afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
You do it beforehand, and you don't do that by just going once there and saying, hey, this is what we want to do, how about it? You get to know the people. You make sure that they fully understand. You do your industry study and everything beforehand, present it to them, walk through it with them and say, now, is this reasonable or is it not? And they never give a carte blanche. They don't do that.
No.
But provided you speak to the right people who will be the decision makers after the event, you give them all the facts at your disposal to show that you have a just cause here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sure that if you get a totally unofficial indication, hey, this doesn't look too bad, then you'd go ahead. But you don't just go ahead and then finally when you've got all the cost estimates done, the engineering completed, and say, okay, now we are ready to go and we're going to go. Well, their hackles rise considerably, mm-hmm. and they say, oh, you think so? Well, mm-hmm. we'll tell you differently. Mm-hmm. And of course, in those days, the antitrust laws were enforced a good deal more rigorously than they have been since then, mm. particularly in the 80s, and in my view, were enforced quite unreasonably with excessive severity, which constituted a restraint of the U.S. economy mm. contrary to the national interest. Mm-hmm. So that was the Questar project.
Learning experience.
Yeah, indeed. And we're now getting to the stage where, with Tom Barrow taking over the leadership of Kennecott, the fight with Curtis Wright, the sale of Peabody, and the subsequent acquisition of Carborundum . The whole structure of the company changed. Bill Wendell was the president of Carborundum, and a new sort of management team evolved. So strategic council was set up, of which I became a member. I had in the meantime become a vice president of Kennecott. I'd been elected a vice president of Kennecott, in charge of exploration and business development. This happened in 1977 or 78, and one of the decisions made was that the copper mining, or at least the whole mining part of the enterprise, should be headquartered in the West, in Salt Lake City. And Glenn Bakken was appointed the president of this entity. The other entities of Kennecott were Carborundum, QIT, Quebec Iron and Titanium. Yeah, those were the three entities. Kennecott bought Carborundum on the 16th of November 1977. And this really brought with it then the restructuring. Tom Barrow came on board in 78, and it was after that that Kennecott was divided up into these units. And Glenn Bakken, let me just continue this train mm-hmm. of thought. Glenn Bakken was appointed president of this new Kennecott Minerals Company, headquartered mm-hmm. in Salt Lake City. Glenn had been the president of Chase Copper and Brass for 22 years. That was still another unit, Chase Copper and Brass. Mm-hmm. And Glenn, whom I'd gotten to know pretty well in my very frequent presentations to the Kennecott board, there's one thing that Frank Millikan insisted on, which I thought was very healthy and was continued by Tom Barry, that if there was a case to be made for expenditures, capital expenditures, the business executive responsible would be hauled up before the Kennecott board, and they would at first hand hear his story instead of getting it through some intermediate echelon. I was up before the board every couple of months, I guess. Hadn't gotten most of the board members pretty well, particularly Glenn Bach and also Peter Grace became a good friend. And Glenn came to me one day and said to me, "Jocklick San," we always used to address each other, San, because we'd been dealing with the Japanese over Chino and other matters. "Jocklick San," he said, "I will be in Salt Lake City from the 1st of April of next year, and I would be honored if you would join me there. If, however, you will not be there, forget about it." I said, "I get the message." And after some very difficult discussions with Pam, because I was by no means certain in my mind that that was the right move, let alone dragging her and the family out to Salt Lake, after a lot of very tough conversations where she showed a great deal of courage, we came to the conclusion that I should seize this opportunity and come out to Salt Lake with Glenn Bach, which I did.
This was, what was the date then? 78?
Well, the first day in the Salt Lake office was May 14th, 1979.
79, okay. Mm-hmm.
Do you think we should...
Peter, I'm here. All right, so... We're continuing now after a break. This is now January 21st, 1994. Continuing Frank Jocklick's interview in Salt Lake City.
Do you want that
Kleenex? No, it seems to be working better this way. I think we get less...
Are we live?
All right, we're live, and this is January 21st.
Well... We'll talk a little bit now about the transition from Connecticut to Salt Lake City. We had been in Connecticut for 5 years, which was really the longest we'd been anywhere since Pam and I got the move from there. Wasn't easy. Fortunately, Katie was in good shape by then, and the reason I say that is that from Connecticut we had periodically done ski trips to Vermont and other parts of New England. You see, before that era and before the kids themselves began to ski, Pam and I had usually headed off to Europe, to Switzerland and Austria and to France for our skiing trips. But with the kids, we just piled everything in the station wagon and headed up to Vermont. And on the last day of the season in... I forget exactly which year it was, but anyway, on the very last day, it was spring skiing, and Katie broke her leg. She had a spiral fracture of the tibia, and she was still on crutches and recovering when, at the Tokanee Club, they had swabbed the deck so to speak, and her crutches slipped and she fell and broke her femur right through the growth plate. So she was laid up for best part of half a year. By the time this move came, she'd recovered fully and she was already skiing again at Bromley and Stratton and the other places we'd frequented. Another milestone was that I had actually survived my 50th birthday in early June. We actually celebrated it in early June of 1978 with a party at home to which we invited a large number of our best friends, and Frank and Barbara Millikan showed up, and it was a very merry evening, for which I was very grateful to Pam and my friends for going to that trouble. As we said, Tom Barrow had been elected president of Kennecott by the time we moved, replacing Frank Millikan. And Glenn Bakken had installed himself in Salt Lake as president of Kennecott Minerals Company. My job in Salt Lake was to be senior vice president technology of Kennecott Minerals Company. Technology embracing engineering, procurement and construction activities, exploration and development of new projects. Maybe there were other things encompassed in that responsibility, but these I think were the main ones. And this gave me a much broader view of Kennecott's overall mining operations than I had had in Connecticut there as Kennecott's vice president of business development. Now,
what was Kennecott, what was KMC's relationship with Kennecott?
It was the major part of Kennecott.
Okay, and which by this time was owned by Sohio, which had been...
No, not at all.
It was not, was still independent.
Kennecott was an independent corporation,
right.
But it did incorporate...
it had Chase and
it, it did incorporate Carborundum at that time.
Okay.
Carborundum had been acquired. Certain things became evident to me soon after I took up residence in Salt Lake in May of 1979. And I spent the summer here in the Little America Hotel, which is a very pleasant place to stay, while the family were still in Connecticut enjoying the summer, because the kids were heavily into swim team competition and were anxious to do their part for the Tokanee Club there. And they came to Salt Lake in September. But during that summer, I worked closely with Glenn Bakken and formed a view of what the position of Kennecott was as a mining company. I didn't put into practice the conclusions that I came to until early the following year when I became president. But one glaring thing to me was the history of misadventures with major capital projects. When I looked back through the record, I saw that every project over $5 or $10 million had overrun substantially in terms of money and time. And even more ominously, the facilities that resulted from such expenditures generally failed to perform according to expectations. In other words, they didn't do the job that they were designed and built for.
And nobody had been evaluating these?
It was surprising. Well, sure, I mean, but the record was very clear. Yet Kennicott had a large central engineering group headquartered at the so-called research center up on the University of Utah campus, and there was also a large, quote, research group, unquote, both of them staffed by, forget how many, but something like 50 or 60 professionals. When I think back on it, I suspect that the failure to perform with projects was a function of the separation between the groups that were based here in Salt Lake and headquarters, which had migrated by then from 42nd Street in Manhattan to a new office building in Stamford, Connecticut. And that in the effort to sell projects from the engineering and research groups, which were charged with their conceptualization and preliminary engineering and design, in selling the project to headquarters, they were enhanced beyond their potential. So the cost estimates were squeezed, schedules were curtailed, and expected performance was glorified. Mm-hmm. And I think at headquarters, they weren't the people really to analyze whether they were getting a snow job or not. And generally that's what they got. And the more they balked at headquarters in dispensing funds for capital projects, the more the projects were gilded before presentation at headquarters. So if you like, there was a basic sort of lack of candid analysis of the problems and the remedies that should be applied to them through capital expenditures that caused this really very, very poor performance on major projects. Now, I was able to take a really hard look at that because of my experience on major projects, particularly Mount Newman, and then even though they didn't materialize or didn't evolve into operations, Mitchell Plateau, North Carolina Phosphate, Cuesta, I had worked on these projects so closely with engineering, procurement, and construction contractors that I had begun to develop a feel for the techniques, the methodologies employed, and I had also developed an ability perhaps to analyze a capital and operating cost estimate and see whether they contain shortcuts or whether they were loaded with extraneous cost items. This disturbed me, and one result was early on in my stay in Salt Lake was the separation of the leadership of the engineering group, because try as I might, I wasn't able to explain to them my concerns that emerged from a review of the record.
Explain to whom?
The leadership of the engineering group.
Okay.
And so we came to a parting of the ways. Now
they were here.
Yeah, right here, yeah. In Salt Lake.
And they were separated from the decision makers in New York, or in Connecticut, but now is this what you mean?
Yeah.
That was the separation.
That's
that
right.
Concerned
you. Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
What parting of the ways?
Well, what do you mean? I mean,
you said you came
had
to a party.
The guy
of
had
the
to be fired, okay? Yeah. Replacement was difficult because.
Now, who had to be fired?
The head of the engineering group.
Who was here?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
A bit of streamline.
No, well, I'm just trying to clarify, because if the separation was his fault. Yeah, communication, he was not communicating right, properly over.
Well, I mean, he'd been responsible for all these failures of capital projects.
All right.
And he had no, evidently, means or intention of remedying the procedures that led to these failures.
Okay.
So replacing him wasn't going to be easy because I realized that unless I brought someone in who had good experience in both engineering and construction, we still wouldn't be making much progress. Because my intention was to make the central engineering group not just a service organization, but a line function whereby major capital projects, by major I mean the limit we established was something over $5 million. Such projects would be turned over to that group and their implementation, completion, and transfer to the operating divisions would be their line responsibility. And also the post-completion reviews would throw light on their performance. So I needed someone who was a good engineer and had also run major projects before. Such people are extremely rare in the business. You get excellent engineers, work for engineering companies, you get excellent construction stiffs, and they work for the construction contractors. And very rarely do you get a guy who can do both. After a prolonged search, I hired a man whom I'd already known for some time and had experience of and with in connection with some of the projects that I'd worked on, and that was Raman Rao, RAO, who was a senior project manager with Bechtel at that time, had excellent education in engineering, graduate degree from Stanford University, and he's had 16 years with Bechtel on project engineering, but also on major project supervision of construction. Raman grew up in India, had his high school and initial tertiary education there, but I felt he had the breadth from his international background to handle projects even as complex as, say, Mount Newman that I've been familiar with. So Raman came on board and he brought with him a handful of professionals from the construction industry. Particularly, he brought with him Dennis Connell, who eventually succeeded him. And he brought others, particularly a couple of guys with strength in cost estimating, which, as far as I could see, Kennicott had no expertise in at all. I made this change in the organization chart whereby Raman, as vice president of engineering and construction, would have total responsibility for major capital projects. And jumping ahead in the years since then, when we built projects total value in excess of $2 billion, there wasn't one that didn't come in within budget, within schedule, and that did not perform after completion in excess of the criteria that we had established in the design. The other thing is that during the remainder of 83, I began to get a feel for Kennecott's competitiveness in the copper mining business, or lack thereof.
Excuse me, there's been a jump here. You succeeded Bakken.
I'm not talking about that. That's to come here.
Was that after 83?
Early 84.
Ah, okay. I'm sorry. I was thinking, yeah. I thought...
No, I was senior vice president.
You were still senior VP.
Technology.
Okay. All right,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. But as part of my duties there, I had a survey done of the cost of our competitors. And confirm what you could read in the press, that Kennecott was possibly the highest cost major domestic producer of copper. And I'm not talking about byproduct values now. I'm talking about total costs, a pound of copper produced. Kennecott was certainly near the top of the cost ladder.
And that's this figure which we can put in. Can we?
Perhaps.
All right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. You're right. That's a...
It was a beautiful analysis of
pictorial
the...
Pictorial representation of it.
The,
yeah.
All the major copper producers and...
Yeah.
Kennecott.
This was really the result of the study. What page is that on?
It's on page 49 of David Morris's report here.
Lee's referring to a monograph, if you like, by Dave Morris, who is manager of planning at Kennecott. And this monograph came about a couple of years ago when Bob Wilson, who is now the chief executive of RTZ, said that he would like a record of the cost reduction measures that took place at Kennecott in the 1980s. So I set Dave Morris to work, and we agreed on an outline, and then I worked with him periodically to develop this monograph, which is entitled Digging Out, Kennecott Resurfaces in an Era of Global Competition. And this was completed by Dave just recently, and is accessible to readers of this material. At that time in 1983, however, I didn't have that breakdown that you referred to there yet. I had a broader set of data, which was still sufficient to convince me that if for no other reason, cost reduction at Kennecott's operations had to be an absolute priority. Now, the reasons for Kennecott's lack of competitiveness were twofold. Some were within management's control, and others were not. There had been sharp escalation of unit cost of production because of the oil shocks of the 70s, and we've already referred to that. The first one was in 1973 and was reflected in Kennecott's poor profitability for the remainder of the 70s. And the other one came in 79 and caused a further escalation of fuel costs. Another reason for rapid cost escalation at Kennecott was the way that labor contracts were negotiated or failed to be negotiated. Contracts came up for renewal or renegotiation every 3 years, and every 3 years they went through the same ritual where there'd be a lot of saber rattling, mainly coming out of headquarters, and that would be transmitted down to the operating divisions, and management sort of took the view, well, this time we'll get them. And of course the unions were thoroughly accustomed to this ploy, and they put proposals on the table, demands on the table that were absolutely outlandish, and the result was that the deadline would come usually on June 30th at midnight, and the two sides would be far apart. They hadn't got serious about negotiating yet. Then the then the alley people would take a little vacation, summer vacation, and start thinking of the hunting season in the fall, after which finally they'd really get serious about going back to work. Management, on the other hand, was adopting a non-yielding attitude. Perhaps there was a little posturing for the shareholders involved here. So on average, you had a strike that ran maybe for 3 months. And in fact, the record shows that over a period of 25 years, there was a strike every time the contract expired, and an average of a month a year was lost, therefore, which was very costly in terms of lost copper production, and of course hurt the pay packets of the unions.
Now, Kennecott was not members. Alone in this. It was an industry-wide problem, wasn't it?
It was. Mm-hmm. But I think Kennecott probably carried it a step further than some of the competitors. But I'll get back to labor relations later on, but mm-hmm. I'm just talking about why it was that Kennecott at that time was not competitive. And that element certainly was within management's control, mm-hmm. but had not been addressed. A second reason for lack of competitiveness, perhaps, was poor maintenance of antiquated facilities. There had been these diversions resulting from the attempts to diversify when I came and came back from Canada and worked in New York, worked on the Ilkenite case. Well, here was, that wasn't really diversification, it was extension of the fabricating fabricating operations of Kennecott, but it certainly took an awful lot of management time. You had the Peabody acquisition and divestiture, which was a major misadventure. You had the acquisition of Carborundum, which turned sour soon after the acquisition, because in the view of some, Carborundum had been dressed up for the kill. And then you had the Curtis Wright attack, where Roland Berner saw the extent to which Kennecott was floundering. He saw that the Carborundum acquisition would do nothing really to improve shareholder values, and he wanted to get control. Now Roland Berner was very unpopular with Kennecott management, which I suppose was personified.